extra copies of yours, and there's one. Yeah. So I've only got my legal sessions. Yeah, Chris, you'll be fine.
Oh, thank you.
Megan,
are you?
Thank you.
Apologise in advance, I've got a bit of a frog in my throat today. So. Right.
Yes.
So, I have not pre-circulated these, so I will flip through them.
That's okay.
In the introductory section, first two paragraphs just clarify that the submissions, that these submissions and evidence on behalf of are all the Jack's Point entities that we act for. Paragraph 1.3, in case no one has the background on the Jack's Point zone, it's an integrated zone which consists of multiple activity areas, including open space, landscape protection, golf courses, commercial, residential, healthcare and education facilities. And the zone essentially provides for a vision of a self-sustaining centre for people to live, work and recreate. And what I've also done is appended the structure plan, which is from the notified version of Chapter 41 from the plan, just so you've got it handy in case you want to figure out where the things are that I'm talking about. So 1.4, the zone provides for numerous, quote, activity areas, which are the little blobs within the structure plan. And the activity area boundary is the dotted line for each activity area. And the ones that I'm particularly going to address you on today and that Mr. Ferguson's evidence is on are the village and the education innovation campus activity areas. So village is also village brackets, Jack's Point brackets is kind of in the middle. And the education innovation campus is on the left side of the page. So the far north is the education innovation campus proposed activity area. And these two areas are separate from the residential areas, and they accommodate retail, commercial, or are intended to accommodate retail, commercial, education, health, recreation, and other associated activities. And the effects of and the receiving environment for those activities are of a different nature to residential, obviously, and the amenity levels anticipated in those areas justify a different noise standard than the residential activity areas. So the relief we're talking about today is in relation to the village and the education activity area, or the EIC. And what I've set out under paragraph 2.1 are quotes from the rules in table 1 of chapter 41 that describe the activities that are contemplated in those areas, which functions as a rule effectively in that table, along with lots of other rules. 2.2. So the nature of the proposed activities and the receiving environment justify a different and higher standard than the residential activity areas in the Jack's Point zone in order to enable the proposed use of the land and control effects to an appropriate level for the receiving environment. Taking into account Section 42A report recommendations, the relief now sought by the submitters can be summarised as identification of a separate standard for the residential, village and EIC activity areas of the zone, extension of the daytime standard from 8 p.m. through to 10 p.m. for the village and the EIC, and an increase in the standards for the village and EIC activity areas from daytime 50 to 60 and nighttime 40 to 50. And amend the status of any breach of the noise standard in the EIC and the village activity area from being non-compliant to a restricted discretionary activity. The Section 42A report and Council's expert evidence recommended that the appropriate noise limit for the village activity be the same as comparable other resort zone commercial hubs, being the 60 and 50 I referred to above, at the boundary of any site or within any site. And this is largely supported by Mr. Ferguson in respect of the village, with the exception of the default activity status in respect of a breach of the standard addressed below. In respect of the appropriate noise limits for the village activity area, there is therefore no disagreement, aside from that one exclusion, and the issue is considered to be relatively settled from our point of view. So the two outstanding issues to be addressed in these submissions relate to providing for the EIC to be subject to the same standard as village, and amending the activity status for breach of the standard from non-complying to restricted discretionary. So inclusion of the village within the same sort of standard as the EIC rather than the same standard as the village. Council's expert, Dr. Charles, considers that the commercial nature of the JPZ village justifies a commercial type of noise standard. And the expert evidence does not address the contemporaneous request from our clients that the EIC also have a more lenient standard. Furthermore, the Section 42A report refers to paragraph 9.1 of Council's expert evidence and agrees with the inclusion of the village activity area in the higher noise standard bracket to ensure that noise in the area is managed appropriately, but also does not consider appropriateness of including the EIC. And this omission is probably an oversight, as there is no express consideration of the appropriateness or otherwise of the EIC also being subject to the same standard as the village or some other standard that reflects its intended use and receiving environment. The common example of commercial activities in the village warranting a higher noise standard is that a patron sitting outside cafes, and it's submitted that the anticipated activities for the EIC are equally of a mixed commercial nature and would be more appropriately managed with the same noise standard as the village. To hold the EIC to a residential amenity standard will not appropriately provide for the efficient use of that activity and is not otherwise managing noise effects to the appropriate level for the receiving environment. And I've set out, just for your reference, the relevant, the one main relevant policy in respect of the EIC from Chapter 41. And note at paragraph 4.7 that restricting activities in the EIC to a standard more appropriate for residential amenity rather than a mixed commercial education node does not give best effect to policy 41.2.1.15. When the village and the EIC activity area structure plan descriptors from rule 41.4.9 are considered alongside each other, the two activity areas provide for activities of a similar nature, at least in respect of noise and receiving environments. The EIC provides for a maximum height of buildings at 10 metres, same as the village, and there's no maximum standard for earthworks. Education, commercial, visitor accommodation and daycare facilities are controlled activities, and there are no specific density restrictions in the EIC. The intention for the EIC is that they provide a hub for commercial education and innovation. It is certainly not an area of the JPZ which is akin to residential areas, and there is no justification for holding it to a residential standard of amenity for noise. And moving on to the, if there's a breach, it defaults to non-complying. The Section 32 report for Chapter 36 does not specifically address or justify the application of non-complying activity status across the plan for breaches of prescribed noise limits. While the operative district plan provides for most noise limits as a zone standard, which means breach defaults to non-complying, continuation of that activity status still requires justification in this process. It is settled law that the activity status of a proposed provision in a plan must be considered in accordance with Section 32 as the most appropriate way to achieve the associated objectives. So delete and policies. And I'll just set out the authority, Court of Appeal authority there. 5.3, it is entirely open to the Council to determine that non-complying status is the most appropriate way to manage the effects of a particular activity and provide for sustainable management. That, however, is a determination based upon active consideration of alternatives and of costs and benefits. The Noise Chapter 36 provides only one objective and policy set, which is not particularly restrictive or precautionary. And it is therefore difficult to justify non-complying status as flowing from these objectives and policies, which only seek to manage and control adverse effects rather than to avoid or preclude them.
Just that regarding the bricks, noise standards as applied throughout the country in almost every district plan I've dealt with have been standards that have to be complied with. And if one seeks a discretionary activity consent and is granted, it is generally as a condition subject to compliance with the noise standards, even if they're in full. If one breaches the noise standard, it doesn't tend to be on a continual basis, does it?
No.
So one can't in advance apply for consent to breach it necessarily, can one?
Well, unless one can model that it is going to be breached.
Mm.
Yes.
So it seems to me that the non-compliance status is almost irrelevant.
Right.
Okay. You either meet the standard or you don't. And if you don't, then you're in breach.
It's an enforcement issue.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I'm unaware of any case, but you might be able to point me to one, where someone doing an otherwise permitted activity has obtained consent to breach the noise standard all by itself.
Mm. I'm not aware of examples. I can only hypothesise that when one was applying for an activity that looked like it might generate noise, you would be expected to satisfy the council that it was going to comply in advance of gaining your consent.
Like an
airstrip. There we go. Mr. Ferguson, probably going to be more helpful than I am.
Yes, but if it's a discretionary activity, noise is in play anyway, and the noise standards aren't necessarily the ones that may be applied to any consent granted. They become guidance.
Mm. Although a lot of these activities out at Jack's Point will be controlled, not permitted.
Yes, but noise is not one of the matters of control, is it?
Well, it's funny you should say that. At the moment, some of the rules and the tables in the Jack's Point zone do have noise as a matter of control.
Right.
Because when the plan was notified, it was only the residential activity areas that were referred to in the noise chapter. And so there are other rules in Chapter 41, in respect of commercial activities and so on, where noise is currently still a matter of control. And so that's one of those situations where when we come back again in February, depending on where things kind of landish here, not that we'll know, you know, we'll have to give the panel for the special zone consideration that full story, because otherwise there's an unhelpful double up.
Yeah.
Well, if they are a matter of control
or discretion,
then the council has discretion as to what level of noise applies in each case. Yeah. They're not bound by
that's
the standard.
Right.
So,
if it's decided it's appropriate that they remain as a matter of control rather than setting a standard.
Yes. What I'm getting to is I see the argument about whether it's restrictive discretionary or non-complying is a really non-argument.
Mm.
But I can't see that it makes any difference to the outcome.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's just probably coming in from a more of a practical perspective is probably follows what you're saying, is that my experience noise has been dealt with on a very isolated, discrete, I'm thinking sort of bars in the town centre zone, and if you're likely to require a consent which models what that effect would be, you can normally identify where that exceedance happens through the modelling. That normally sort of then goes down a process of getting affected party approval, and in my experience, once you've got those affected party approvals, then normally consent is granted. So the practice, you know, from my experience at least, has been that resource consents are not dealt with as you would think through a non-compliant activity consent status through a wider assessment of the broader objectives and policies of the plan. They're very much dealt with, like you might think of a restricted discretionary activity, as being an activity which is contemplated by the zone, subject to managing its effects. And I guess that's probably where it sort of flows in my brain, at least from the language of the policies and objectives are more around management of effects than try to deal with some broader policy issue.
I suppose if you I mean, I can understand the theoretical position, Mr. Ferguson, but taking a practical view, Section 104D, do you think there'd be any application to breach the noise limits which would be contrary to the objectives and policies in Chapter 36?
Exactly. I mean, I agree. And
so, you know, so if I get through that threshold.
So, but that cuts both ways, of course. I mean, that, you know, if that is the case, what is it achieving?
Well, but I'm just wondering whether also there's any that it's helpful for Jack's point to have a different status from everywhere else, because theoretically there's a position that may be correct, albeit unnecessary.
And there is a component in what we're sort of saying. The evidence is a little bit dealing with it as a district wide issue at an academic level. And you know, there might be restrictions on scope as to where they can go, and acknowledge that completely. We've done a submission, obviously, that relates to Jack's point, and that's its primary concern. I mean, I guess if you're looking for some precedent, if you like, as to how it's been managed in other districts, I think the unitary plan in Auckland might give you some from steering how that's kind of where that's landed in terms of RDA. But yeah, I mean, there is a flavour of that, and it might be that couldn't be achieved on a global basis within scope, but certainly the Jack's point it could be.
The other point that we didn't address in writing, but that is a risk or a concern, is the proposed rule from Mr. Ferguson and the matter over which discretion is reserved is, you know, specifically focused on the effects. Whereas if it was a non-complying, if a breach triggered a non-complying status and the rest of the activity was bundled, all of a sudden it's quite a different decision-making process and evaluation of that activity. Whereas under the framework we're proposing, if it breaches the noise standard, then the matter, the discretion is reserved over the effect of that breach, and then the remainder of the activity, that's either discretion or control, reserved over the matters listed in the plan if it's bundled in a consenting package. So it's a more appropriate decision-making framework that's focused on effects rather than if there's a risk the whole thing gets bundled into non-complying. You know, it changes the notification process, the decision-making framework, and so on.
If we were minded to agree with the 60 dBA limit during the daytime and the longer hours, are there any applicants that you have in mind that are going to come in and say, before they lodge their application, are we going to exceed those limits? Or is it more likely that after they establish, it's discovered that they are on occasion exceeding them?
I think I can probably talk to that. I'm not aware of any activities that have been promoted by my client within the village that are likely to exceed, as a one-off, that noise standard.
Well, I mean, as part of their operation, because that's, if they're not doing that, they'll have consent and be established, won't they?
Well, that's right. Yeah,
the entire operation would be up for grabs if there's a breach.
I think it's probably more about the second scenario that you were talking about, which is that overall environment, once it becomes developed, to contain those sort of activities. What could that lead to in terms of a cumulative standard of noise within the ambient environment? And I guess taking the Queenstown Town Centre as an example, you know, it used to be that the operative rules and plan, you could never actually meet them if you did nothing, because the ambient noise levels already exceeded the standards in the plan anyway. So, you know, it's important to set a standard that reflects the character and the amenity that's going to be created from that composition of activities. And so, this is why agreeing with the evidence for council by Dr. Childs, that those sort of activities are more tolerant, and, you know, he was suggesting the higher standard, and I think that's appropriate for those reasons.
Okay. I think any questions?
Thank you. The 9,000 are generally exceeded by everyone just living in the house.
What was it?
It's just a. It's more of a, it's not a question, more a point of interest in that the practicalities of doing something, the plan may see A, B, and C, whatever it does, but the practicalities of opening a cafe or having someone sitting outside, and everyone's going to accept that that's perfectly fine. Normal background noise, irrespective of whether it meets the. You don't normally have people walking around with decibel meters going, you're laughing a little too loud. And traffic noise in general. I did, we did an exercise in cinema whereby we had to not exceed, and the number of times we tried to measure whether we were exceeding it was outdone by the traffic noise going past on the screen.
The only instance I know in Monica of consistent breaches of the noise level is a nightclub.
Yes.
In Ardmore Street.
Mm-hmm.
And it was when, for smoking, they had to go out onto a balcony and they left the door open and all the music noise.
Oh,
and it went into the residential area.
It was actually the residential area, being a new motel was built, so residential area actually intruded into
it. But if the door was kept closed, there was no problem.
No problem.
Yeah.
I think
it could be a legitimate noise rule ban smoking.
I think we should hear Mr. Ferguson's summary before we delve further into questions.
If you have a copy of my press letter, you'd like to take it.
Yes, but I don't have your summary yet.
I don't have a summary.
You don't.
I'm
more than happy to reduce the amount of paper I should have.
Thank you. So I didn't prepare a separate summary. It was fairly succinct as it was. So, and having made some preliminary comments already, I sort of set out in my executive summary on page 2. At paragraph 3.1 to 3.3, just the overview of where we're heading with my thoughts on noise chapter, supporting the amendments within the Section 42A report and the evidence of Dr. Charles, in terms of the noise standard which applies to the village. However, because of the nature of the commercial activities envisaged within the EIC activity area, I also consider it appropriate to place the same noise standards for there. I raise some concern around the interpretation of the rules, and I'll get to that a little bit more further down the line, but it's between the standards that apply to the zones the sound is received in and the assessment locations that are stipulated at any point within the site. I'll come back to that. And then I talk about the default status of the breach of the noise standard, and so we've talked around that already. In my observation, it's the status doesn't align with the language which is used in the relevant or higher order objectives and policies, which is more about managing adverse effects of noise. And in my view, a breach of the noise standard would be more appropriately addressed as a restricted discretionary activity, and that would align with the higher order provisions and enable a more targeted assessment of effects. I might skip through the next section, which just summarises the relief that was sought by Jack's point. It's been covered in legal submissions. As the Section 42A report was, we're sort of arriving at a summary of what's left over of the issues, if you like, at about my paragraph 6.2 on page 5, which I see is the remaining issues being, or arising as a consequence, being the addition of the EIC to the commercial noise standards, the clarification of how the noise standards are applied between the stipulated assessment locations and the activity areas to which sound is received, and then finally the status of the noise breach. So paragraph 6.3, I just sort of set out a discussion around the application of the higher noise standards for commercial related activities within the EIC. It wasn't addressed specifically within the Central Point of Tauira report, and it may have been an oversight, I'm not sure. But in any event, if that wasn't an oversight, then it's my evidence that the composition of those type of activities would be similar to the outcomes which are expected within the village in terms of noise. And taking into account the nature of those activities and the evidence of Dr. Childs, I think I consider it appropriate to incorporate the EIC into those commercial rules, which is 36.55 of the revised proposal. And at the bottom of my evidence, I set out the changes to the rule.
Mr. Ferguson, in terms of either Dr. Childs or Ms. Evans, when they were with us yesterday, they gave summaries. Have you had a chance to look at those to see whether they then made a comment on it?
Okay.
Sorry. No, sir, I haven't.
That's a quick look.
If they
agree with you.
Dr. Charles agreed with you on the EIC.
I think the only
contention is whether it's not compliant or not to discretion.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's great.
Yeah. We agree.
We're quite so happy you guys need
to. Well, I won't push hard. Put harder and harder on the door. I guess the second issue that we had then was with respect to the clarification of how the rules worked, and I found this really hard to follow, and I did this as a job. It talked about assessment locations within Table 2 at any point within the site. And then you've got the clarification rule that says that the noise limits in Table 2 do not apply to assessment locations within the same site. So I took that to mean that everything beyond the site is the site for measurement purposes. But then you've got the change to the wording of the column in Table 2 that applies the standards to the zone, the sound is receiving. So that when you bring those two changes together, it's my understanding that the rules is that we're requiring sound generators to comply with A, the noise limits for the sound beyond the site within the activity it's located in and within the zone within which it's located. So if you took the example of the village, say, you have to comply with the sound limit at the boundary of your site within the village. And then B, you're also required to meet the noise limits for sound beyond the site within which the activity is located and within the adjoining zone. So the case of the village, you'd have to comply at the nearest zone boundary or the activity area boundary, because that's another word I suggested is the activity area, because it's part within the zone. Then you'd also have to comply with that. So in the case of the Jacks Point Village, which I bring up in 6.6, you could be required to comply with your 60 dB at the site boundary, and then, because that's the standard set for that area, and the 50 daytime limit would be for the residential activity that it adjoins. So I think that's how I understand it to apply, but it took me a bit to work that out, and I really do think it would benefit from some clarification wording and how that actually works or is intended to work.
I think I agree that that's what I think it means too, and the way you've done your alterations, your recommended alterations, are the same point. Am I correct that within the village area, received sound can be up to 60 dBA until 10 o'clock at night?
Yeah.
And then
at the boundary of the site.
Well. And no matter where it's received from. Mm. But when in the adjoining zone, received sound is, or the adjoining activity area, which is residential, then it is 50 dBA. Is that?
That's how I how I understand it's intended to work, but I must say it took a bit of working out to get to that point.
Yes.
I really do think that, you know,
we're
having that problem getting to that
we'll
point.
We'll have a look and see if we can
but
make
I think
it clearer as well.
So I think what comes from that, though, is that if you're talking about the sound as whether it's received in, to bring about, I guess, the how zones are structured, like Jack's point, but it could be relevant for other areas where there's a structure, and I think it'd be good to useful to refer to the activity area as well. Because that's going to be a distinct area that's operating very similar to like a zone would.
Yes.
So that's why I suggested that amendment. Yeah.
It may yes. Activity areas and subzones have to be treated as if they were zones for the purpose of noise. It's probably the answer.
Yeah, it could be that there's a clarification potentially. Number of multiple ways of handling it, but it's just to say zone might be misleading. Yeah. As it is, it's probably not a good way to leave it just as it is. So I guess what I'm trying to say in that last sentence in 6.6 is that I'm really reliant on the evidence of Dr. Childs that when he talks about a more legal standard for the village, taking into account that dual standard, the dual implications of the standard, then, you know, that is appropriate. So, yeah. The next part of my evidence, I suppose, is this general submission concerning the status of the activity, and the activity in breach of the relevant noise standards that would apply to the village and the EIC, which was sought in the submission to be restricted discretionary rather than non-compliant. The submission proposed to limit the discretion to the effects of noise in adjoining zones. So conceptually I talk about this, and I don't understand why status for the breach of noise should default to non-compliant. The objectives that are proposed for Chapter 36 are succinct and seek to control the adverse effects of noise emissions to a reasonable level. And when you couple that with the objectives of the Jack's Point Zone in Chapter 41, they will enable a range of activities anticipated for the village activity area to be carried out under a suitable framework of controls over noise. The language of the association associated policies follows this general theme by seeking to manage subdivision land use and development activities and to avoid, remedy or mitigate adverse effects. Adoption of a non-compliant activity trigger for the majority of the zones within 36 is not widely supported by the wording of the relevant objectives and policies. I recognise that in the context of the changes proposed within the revised proposal to include the village within Rule 36.5, these changes may be limited by the scope to make wider amendments to status within other zones. So in the event that scope is provided through submissions, I consider restricted discretionary activity status more appropriate, aligning with the relevant objectives and policies. In Chapter 6.10, I look at the comparison of the discussion which has been through for subdivision, where council is satisfied the status of restricted discretionary activity is appropriate to manage the actual potential effects of subdivision. Noise is an activity with much less complexity than subdivision and resulting in typically localised effects on the amenity values of people and communities. The scope of the discretion suggested for Rule 36.6.5 would, in effect, provide mere unfettered scope to apply consent for activities that breach the noise standard. The extent of the effects of noise on adjoining zones or activity areas. In my view, reliance on non-compliant activity status for an assessment of a breach of the noise limits is unnecessary to implement the objectives of the plan. So I set out in 7.1 my proposed amendments to the revised proposal, 36.6.5, and so those amendments include the addition of the words activity area to the column heading, first column heading, to deal with this particular issues of Jack's Point and their composition of strain, but that equally might be expanded to include subzones, for example. And then just technically it's the Jack's Point zone rather than the Jack's Point resource zone. and the addition of the EIC, along with the matters of restriction of discretion on the non-compliance activity status. Now, there was one other thing, actually, I wanted to raise, and it's not in my evidence, but I did want it to bring to your attention in case you hadn't already noticed it. There is a rule, there's a clarification rule on 36.321. And it says that the following tables describe activity standards and subsequent level of activity for resource consent purposes. Any activity that is not permitted requires resource consent, and any activity that is not specifically identified in a level of activity but breaches standards requires resource consent as a non-compliant activity. Now,
that's gobbledygook.
That's quite sorry.
That is gobbledygook.
I was going around circles with that because the table 2 is set out general standards, the standards that are set out in there are not based on activities and are based on zones and activity areas within which the sound is received. So it's not based on activities. So it sets up a theoretical trigger for consents for just about anything under that will become non-compliant. So I see potentially difficulties in the operation of that.
I suspect the author wasn't really understanding what they were doing. It's probably a nice way to put it.
But I mean,
the author isn't in the room, so.
Remind me not to leave the room.
Noise is an effect, it's not an activity. There are certain activities that are prescribed in Table 3, so I think that just needs to be looked at too.
Yes. But in large part, the chapter is about setting standards.
Yes.
That's what the chapter is about, yes.
Yeah.
Just returning to your last paragraph of your evidence, you suggest as a restricted discretionary activity that discretion is restricted to the extent which effects of noise generated on an adjoining zone or activity areas. Do you not consider that the effects of noise breaches within the zone, the same activity area, may be relevant?
Yeah, I do. And I think it was just the way the perhaps it reflected the wording of what the standards were when they were notified and talked about the breach, the assessment implications of the boundary. So, I agree that in conceptually that it should properly relate to the effects within the zones, potentially within the zones. So.
Related to that, just in terms of the structure of this in 7.1,
yes,
with the non-compliant status, normally the rest of the plan that's sitting, what the matters of discretion are in regard to that, are sitting somewhere else completely. Could it be done that this is amended to make it look like the other parts, like in the rural chapters or something like that, wherever it sort of sits within the structure of those rules properly?
Yes, I think that, yeah, definitely. Doesn't necessarily have to be set out in that way. Just trying to think whether it might.
I think the subdivision chapter probably provides now with the officers of the
court. Right, so I've got the example actually was on page 4 of the rules, the standards that are
as notified.
Applying.
As notified.
As notified, yeah. So the Queenstown Airport mixed use zone is standards that when you breach those to become a restricted discretionary activity. We've got restrictions on your discretion, and that looks frighteningly similar to what we put in our submission.
It doesn't look like the rest of the plan.
No.
Yeah,
it doesn't look like it's as it's set out in, like in the rural chapter at all, where it sets out and this is an RDA and the matters for discretion and council restricts its discretion over these matters, bullet point, bullet point.
And then that probably would be a tidier way to go.
Yeah, the difference, of course, between its use zone is actually has no noise limits at all within the zone.
Yes, and I think so. That's your point's well founded, isn't it? So that really does need to relate to the site. That's at the site.
Mm.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay.
Positive agree first.
No, I think that's fine. I think we understand all the risk to understand, and I don't have much of a contention.
Thank you.
Okay,
thank you
very
much.
Had a very good day today. I hope this is an indication that it's going to be like this from now on.
I'm sure it will. Thank you very much.
That's all right.
And some of it's probably not that. Maybe, you know, it's. I'm not following procedures or haven't understood the. Some of the instructions I've received. Not being a lawyer or a planner, sorry. I'll be fine. And some of it's probably coming out of left field, but I'll give it a go.
I would always take quality over quantity any day of the week.
It's not quality. Oh, I don't know. I did attempt to. It's double sided, by the way. I wrote a submission, but I didn't really follow this section 42 report and report it back very well. So I only found that yesterday. So I haven't necessarily addressed issues in that.
That's okay. If you just take us through.
So I'm just addressing section 32, energy and utilities. In general, this section does not cover the residential use of energy in any detail. The consumer is a fundamental part of any sustainable energy system. Sustainability cannot be addressed without consumer involvement. I specifically address renewable energy, wood, and solar energy as they concern residential sites. In my original submission, I asked for changes as follows, but did not suggest any rewording of policies rules. And I guess I'm concentrating on policies rather than rules. The housing density in our town urban zone shall not be increased on the basis of current measured PM10 concentrations of respirable particulate matter in the atmosphere. This is known to have a severe effect on the health of people. The installation of photovoltaic panels and roofing profiles suitable for photovoltaic laminates shall be a permitted activity under the plan in the Arrowtown Residential Historic Management Zone. Now, I think that was picked up by the Section 42 report or whatever it was, and it was going to be held over, I think, in relation to planning or to the historic considerations of its of the Arrowtown Historic Management Zone. But many residents in Arrowtown are currently dependent on wood for home heating. Consequently, there is a substantial emission of wood smoke during the winter months. Since May 2016, the National Environmental Air Quality Standard for PM10 particles less than 10 microns has been exceeded 30 times at the point of sampling in Arrowtown. And currently legislation permits about once per annum. The World Bank reported last week that air pollution is the fourth leading cause of premature deaths worldwide behind smoking, diet and obesity, and is known to lead to cancers in heart, lung and respiratory diseases. The New Zealand Ministry for the Environment's 2011 User's Guide, updated 2014 National Environment Standards for Air Quality, NES, says in section 44A78 of the RMA, requires that every local authority and consent authority must observe national environmental standards. Every local authority and consent authority must enforce the observance of national environmental standards to the extent to which their powers enable them to do so. The user guide also says under section 5.4, role of territorial authorities, compliance with the open fire bans and wood burner standards is the responsibility of the regional councils. However, in practice, the role of the territorial authorities is paramount. So I guess I base this submission on, you know, in relation to energy around those points. Under Objective 32.3 in the Energy and Utilities, energy resources are developed and electricity is generated in a manner that minimises adverse effects on the environment. A policy to control wood burning in locations where the NES air quality is not being met should be included in the district plan, in my opinion. This would assist the Otago Regional Council to meet their obligations. This is suggested that 32.3 is changed to energy resources are used and developed, just so the use is taken into account, and and reading the introduction to the energy and utilities, I sort of got mixed messages of whether doing good energy use, so I didn't see where energy use came in. And from there, and a policy is added, in air sheds where the National Environmental Air Quality Standard for PM10 is not currently being met, wood burning appliances are not permitted to be installed in new homes. If the increased density of housing is permitted in some areas of Arrowtown under the Queenstown Lakes District Council proposed district plan, this policy would limit PM10 discharges from wood burning appliances to current levels until a solution is developed in cooperation with the Otago Regional Council to enable the NES air quality for PM10 to be met. I think, you know, that's proactive. Coming on to the solar energy one, and I guess this came from personal experience more than anything else. Despite the relatively detailed mention of the use of solar energy in the introduction to Section 30, there is only a single policy: encourage small and community-scale distributed electricity generation and solar water heating structures within new or altered buildings. Under 30.2 Objective, site layout and buildings design takes into consideration energy efficiency and conservation. So that policy appears under that objective. And under this objective, I'm suggesting allow the installation of solar panels and photovoltaic panels on homes throughout the district as a permitted activity. You know, I think that's a move towards sustainability, as the RMA's plan to address it. Permit the installation of roofing profiles on homes suitable for fixing photovoltaic laminates throughout the district, including the Arrowtown Residential Historic Management Zone. Now, in the Arrowtown Residential Management Zone, you're only allowed to use corrugated iron at present, unless you make a very good case for using another roof profile. And there are several roof profiles available which you can fix solar laminates too, which permit you to, you know, generate solar power. And they're unobtrusive, you know, in I guess on a roof or anything like that. But the only issue is it's not corrugated iron. And then, in regards to sustainability, it is essential that the use of solar energy is permitted and not prohibited by policies in the plan. There should also be a clause relating to the density of tree canopies. This is a bit left field. For example, the street trees in our residential historic management zone. It is suggested that a further policy is added, the council will manage the street tree canopies to permit at least 30% of solar radiation from the sun to reach shaded properties at all times. And one other point, which I probably didn't submit on, but I think is worth considering, under the efficient management of solid waste, which was a policy, reads encouraging methods, the policy under that, sorry, I should have highlighted under that objective, ensure the efficient management of solid waste, reads encouraging methods of waste minimization and reduction, such as reuse and recycling. And the disposal of waste to landfill is not sustainable and, amongst other things, contributes to global warming. Policies should be added to direct the council into a proactive identification of waste streams that can be eliminated or reduced to the benefit of the community as a whole. For example, construction and building waste, green waste, food waste, but tourist waste. And that, so add a policy, identify waste streams that can be eliminated and or reduced and work with waste stream owners to develop action plans. That's all. Thank you very much.
Now, let's check to see if there's any questions on this.
I think we're wrong. I think there's a little quality in it. I
couldn't, because of the limited time and limited space, I limited what I wrote down and references and stuff like that.
So I will adjourn till 3:50.